Hello everyone, and welcome again to the Associate Affiliate Cricket Podcast. We've got a couple of previews today of the ACC Elite Trophy and the European Tournament in Hungary. The North Sea Pro Series is concluded, and we have some previews of World Cricket League Division 4 and Europe Division 2, as well as a couple of other one day games between the Netherlands and Scotland. And to join me for that is regular co-host Andrew Nixon. Hi Andrew.
Hi Russ, hi everybody.
Andrew, start with the ACC Elite Trophy. This was the tournament that would promote them to the Premier Trophy for the winner. We had predicted at the start that Singapore was most likely going to be the team that went through, which was the case, but basically from the first game they put themselves in a position where it was going to be very, very hard.
Yeah, on the opening day they were bowled out by Saudi Arabia for 149. And then Saudi Arabia knocked off the runs relatively comfortably. They lost a few wickets, but won with almost 10 overs to spare. It's pretty much this. I think it's maybe the second or the third time that a team I've picked as favourites to win an Asian tournament has lost to Saudi Arabia on the opening day. I seem to be a curse against the team I've become favourites when they play in Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia went on to have a very good tournament, a very surprising tournament in many ways.
Yeah, they're an interesting case that they have quite a lot of players in Saudi Arabia. They do relatively well in the ICC scorecard, so it's perhaps in some ways surprising that they haven't done well before now. But they smashed their way through the opening few rounds, beating Bhutan by 300 runs, scoring 438 for 4. Bhutan themselves had a very poor tournament. They then lost to Singapore by 282 runs in the next game. In fact, they lost all their games pretty badly.
Yeah, when you suppose their tournament is summed up when you look at their net run rate, which is minus 4.7, which essentially means that their average result was a 235 run defeat. A pretty poor performance by Bhutan. It's worth mentioning. There is a little bit of context around what happened to Bhutan. It goes actually back as far as 2009, when in the ACC Challenge, when they were drawn in a group against China and Burma. It was China making their international debut, and Burma the previous year, I think, had been bowled out for 10 by Nepal, so it wasn't a particularly challenging group. And then they ended up getting promoted from that ACC Challenge into the ACC Elite League in 2010, which was then the top division, of course. And in that tournament, Bahrain actually pulled out, and because Bhutan were in that group, that meant that Bhutan couldn't get relegated from the 2010 tournament, which they played very badly. And then they played very badly again in the 2012 ACC Elite, which was then again the top division. And then with the restructure, that meant that they were automatically in this second division, ranked 10th in Asia, essentially, when they were nowhere near really that good. They were sort of there on the back of one good performance against some very weak teams in 2009, and then essentially luck kept them upranked as high as they are. So despite their relatively high ranking going into the tournament, that was pretty much a false ranking, so it's not that surprise that they struggled.
Going into the last day of the tournament, Andrew, we had a few interesting matches teed up. Kuwait, Saudi Arabia and Singapore were all close enough to win the tournament if results went the right way. Saudi Arabia was extremely well placed, having a net run rate of a bit over 2 compared to 1 for the other two teams, and basically just needing not to lose badly against Kuwait and hope that Singapore didn't annihilate Maldives by an awful lot. There was also a relegation game between Bahrain and Bhutan. Perhaps we'll start with the relegation, because we're talking about Bhutan. Bhutan lost this one by 172 runs, and again, they weren't really ever in it.
Although it was in many cases, 172-run defeat was actually their best performance, which doesn't say much. You know, nobody scored a century against them in this match. Yeah, again, pretty disappointing with Bahrain, who hadn't played particularly well in the tournament up until this game, scoring 317, and then Bhutan bowled out for 145. Bhutan, to be fair, did have a the odd player put in a decent performance in almost all their matches. In this one, it was Jigme Singye, who took 3 for 53 and scored 42. He's the captain of the side. And they had other individual performances throughout the tournament that were, you know, reasonably good. It's just that it was only ever one player who performed well for them. And yeah, as we already discussed, they struggled and have been relegated to the Challenge League.
In the other two matches, the Kuwait Saudi Arabia game started late, and by the time it started, Singapore had probably just about finished off Maldives. Maldives were bowled out for 73 off 27 overs, and that was chased down in only 6.3 overs by Singapore with a loss of 2 wickets. So their net run rate immediately jumped up to 3, which meant that Saudi Arabia had to win the other game, and Kuwait had almost no chance in theirs.
Yeah, a very comprehensive win by Singapore in that game against the Maldives, and just what they needed. You know, Maldives never really in the game, and you're only your three players getting into double figures, and three batsmen getting out for ducks. Very very comprehensive win by Singapore in the end, and Saudi Arabia just needed to avoid defeat to Kuwait, but it certainly didn't. To avoid heavy defeat to Kuwait, but it certainly didn't turn out that way.
Yeah, and they were basically thrashed by Kuwait, I think it's probably fair to say. The match was reduced to 47 overs. Saudi Arabia made 205 for 7, and Kuwait, on the back of an innings by Mohammad Irfan of 129 off 68 balls, he was dropped fairly early on, according to the match reports, but he basically powered Kuwait to the 206 chasing off only 24 overs.
Yeah, Saudi Arabia started the game pretty badly. They were 7 for 3 in the 4th over, and then 33 for 5 in the 9th over, and it took a bit of a middle order fight back from Afzal Salim and Mohammed Nadeem to get them to that 205, but then they just came up against Mohammad Irfan, who played one of the best innings he's ever played. 129 from 68 balls is an absolutely superb performance, whatever the level.
That meant Singapore went through, which is, as I say, it was looking a little bit unlikely going into the last day, but in the end, the favourite got through.
Singapore will be delighted with this. They've been struggling in ACC tournaments in recent years, so they'll be pleased to have got a win under the belt. It's probably worth saying, due to the restructure of tournaments, Singapore and Saudi Arabia have essentially gone from being the weakest teams in sort of 8 and 10 team tournaments to being the strongest teams in a 6 team tournament. So their performances are essentially the same teams, but because they're playing against weaker opposition rather than stronger opposition, they're performing a lot better, and I think this shows to some extent why the ACC decided to restructure the tournaments.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to track how they perform when they go up, because obviously playing against weaker opposition, and Singapore's actually had quite a while now where they haven't had a lot of strong oppositions except for some of their World Cricket League tournaments, one of which is coming up soon. So it'd be interesting to see how they go when probably even including World Cricket League Division 4, when they come up against that higher level opposition, given how long it's been since they've played.
You're right. And the key is to avoid becoming a yo-yo team, just get promoted one year, get relegated to the next, and so on. And there's a lot of strong teams in that ACC Premier League, as we saw earlier in the year, and Singapore will have to perform well to avoid being relegated right back down.
There was another tournament, Andrew, in Hungary. It was not an ICC tournament. It was organised by the local cricket organisation in Hungary. It involved Austria, who will be using this preparation for European Division 2, as well as Malta and Poland, and a combined team, as well as a Hungary A team. It was an interesting format. It played out over a few days, a group stage, and then semis, and then a final on the Sunday. We don't have all the scorecards, but Malta was the team that actually came through the best, which is possibly a slight surprise, given that Austria's probably would have been the favourite tournament.
Austria is certainly a bit of a setback for them as part of their preparation for European Division 2, and you know, they sort of beat Poland reasonably convincingly and beat Hungary B quite convincingly as well, but then came up against the combined team in the semi-final and were beaten quite reasonably heavily, and with you know, Malta beating Poland in that semi-final, the other semi-final, and then Malta managed to beat the combined team, which was something of a surprise. The combined team was a very strong team. It had some cricketers from the UAE in it, I believe, and a very strong team. So Malta will be absolutely delighted with this, and have given themselves a good boost for their hopes of getting back into a formal ICC Europe competition.
The other tournament that concluded since we last spoke, Andrew, was the North Sea Pro Series. That was both a 2020 competition and a 50-over competition, and the Scottish Highlanders won both competitions in the end?
It's been a reasonably successful tournament with the Highlanders winning both the 2020 and one-day tournaments, as you say. It's been spoiled a little bit by the weather. I think holding it in the early part of the season has perhaps been a mistake, and maybe next year they can look at playing it in sort of late June, early July, rather than late May and early June. And maybe we can try and get a more completed tournament so that the weather isn't controlling the result too much. And you know, there's also still the question about whether the Irish provincial side should be involved in this league as well. And yeah, overall a successful tournament, and I think Highlanders probably just about the deserved winners.
Yeah, its main use is obviously going to be to get the players up to playing a regular standard of high cricket, and should hopefully also see a few players come through from this tournament into the Scottish side or the Dutch side?
I mean, that's certainly the intention. There is the question about how long the tournament will continue, though, as well, with obviously the Netherlands no longer have ODI status and therefore are no longer part of the top-level high-performance programme, and you know, the TAP funding, which is currently being used to fund this, has apparently been scrapped. So yeah, hopefully the tournament can continue, and it was good to see that although it ended up being mostly a washout, that the final 50-over game was live-streamed by Quipu TV. They provided highlights of most of the other games as well, which is good to see. And hopefully this tournament can become more high-profile so that they don't have to rely on that ICC funding to be able to fund the tournament. Maybe they can get some your local TV in Scotland or the Netherlands to cover it as well, and eventually start making money that way instead of from sponsorship and whatnot.
Joining us now on the Associate and Affiliate Cricket Podcast is former Ireland international and current Denmark coach Jeremy Bray. Thanks for coming on the show, Jeremy.
No problems at all, mate.
As I said, you're now the coach of Denmark and preparing to go to Singapore for World Cricket League Division 4 at the end of the month. How are the preparations for the tournament going?
Yeah, really good. You know, we've had a solid 3 months preparation, primarily working on, you know, what we're going to face in Singapore, which I'd say would be a lot of spin bowling. So that's pretty much been the basis of our, in regards to the batting side of things and just with the bowling. Really working on just hitting good areas, specific areas that we're going to target when we go over there, and working hard on our death bowling, you know, executing our Yorkers and slower balls, which is going very, very well, I must say. And obviously having the advantage of Amjad Khan back is a massive bonus for us.
Yeah, it must bring a lot of experience to the side, someone who's obviously played for England a couple of times now, back for Denmark for the first time in a long time.
Yeah, he's a class operator, and he's shown that throughout an extensive county career with different counties, and I'd have no doubt that he'd probably be still playing high level county cricket if it wasn't for a lot of the injuries that he had. And he just showed when we played against Guernsey, he only played in the first game, but he just ripped through their top order. He was just too quick and just more about the quality that he delivers, with the ball, is it's just high class. And you know, I'd like to think that he, you know, he certainly will be a massive weapon for us when we go to Singapore.
I suppose that sort of express pace bowling is something that a lot of players aren't used to at this sort of level.
Well, that's it. You know, I think at any stage, you know, right through the associate levels, even you know, in Division One, I think when the bowling gets up, you know, above sort of 85 miles an hour, then, you know, you'll find that most associate countries do struggle with that. I know it's got a little bit better now with, you know, a lot of the associate players playing sort of in England, especially the Irish guys, so they're subjected to, you know, quite quick bowling, but, you know, I'd like to think, you know, Division 2, Division 3 and 4 and that, they certainly wouldn't be used to facing blokes that bowl, you know, quite quick. So, you know, again, that's a huge advantage that we have with Amjad.
You mentioned that you've been working on the batting. Batting was certainly a problem for Denmark in the World 2020 qualifier. Last month, also that's before your time as Denmark coach. But how is that sort of progressing? Are you confident that you'll be able to sort of bat out the full 50 overs? And
yeah, listen, you know, there's no doubt that the talent is there. It's just, you know, obviously the conditions that the guys playing over there are not really conducive to, you know, guys learning how to score runs on a regular basis. Like they play on sort of matting, which is, you know, synthetic matching, which is quite very slow, and then add to that is very slow, heavy outfield, you know, and the blokes over here, most of the guys, you know, would be of Asian heritage, and they wouldn't be big, strong guys, so a lot of them rely on, you know, pace on the ball, and, you know, and unfortunately that doesn't really happen over in the conditions over here, so, you know, it's quite difficult for them, and I think, you know, that's something that Danish cricket sort of, you know, really need to sort of rectify if, you know, they want to get the best out of their players. As I said, the talent is certainly there, but just the conditions that these guys have to play in, you know, aren't suitable for, you know, guys wanting to play and succeed at higher levels.
Do you think the batting has perhaps been a little too over-reliant on Freddie Clocker in recent years?
Yeah, listen, definitely, you know, Freddie's been the mainstay there, but it was good to see when we played Guernsey, Freddie didn't play in the second game, and when a young opener that we brought in got 100 not out, and a few of the other guys chipped in around, so which when we chased down, I think it was about 240, and we did it very easily, so, you know, that was a really good sign. You know, but we have, as I said again, you know, there is some very, very talented guys here, so it's a little bit of, you know, I don't know what to expect, to be honest. You know, I think if these guys play to their ability and enjoy actually the wickets that they're going to play on and the grounds, which no doubt are going to be fast, and give themselves an opportunity to get in, I think we'll do very, very well. But then, you know, that's you know, down to the individuals to you know, adapt and really put a high price on their wickets, which unfortunately doesn't happen often enough over in Denmark in the, you know, in the club scene over here, where you don't really see guys scoring a lot of runs on a consistent basis.
So, other than Freddie Clocker and Amjad Khan, who should people following the tournament look out for performing for Denmark?
Yeah, obviously, you know, Michael Patterson's a very classy cricketer. You know, I think I don't think he's performed as well as his ability, you know, shows. But you know, I'm really sure that, you know, if he's fully fit, he's got a bit of a hamstring injury at the moment, so I'm hoping that, you know, that's nothing serious. But I think if he can bat to his potential, he's an outstanding cricketer. But probably the younger guys, there's Hamid Shah, who's, you know, he looks a serious, serious player. And Zamir Khan, who, you know, he got 100 against Guernsey there, is very classy as well. So there's no doubt about the class there, but it's about putting it all together. You know, I think that's going to be the issues that we face, I think, in the batting department.
And what do you know about your opponents in the tournament?
Yeah, I think, you know, they'll all be tough. I think we've played Jersey, Denmark's played Jersey a lot over the last couple of years and have, you know, come out on the right end of, you know, the wins. Italy, and well, listen, from what I've heard, Jersey has really improved over the last couple of years too. I think in the last Division 5 and Division 6 tournaments, they haven't lost a game. So, you know, they're obviously going to be riding high, and they've got some very experienced cricketers. Italy, you know, obviously a lot of expats there, you know, there's Australian, South African, so they're obviously going to be very, very tough indeed. But again, I think we've had, you know, some good matches against Italy that have gone either way. Singapore and Malaysia and Oman, I wouldn't know a great deal about. I think the guys know a lot more about them than I do, and they've sort of given me some good information on them. But again, they're going to be a lot of Asian-style cricketers that play, you know, in the Asian way, so it's very, very attacking. But, you know, I think if we put these, you know, these teams under pressure, then hopefully, you know, they'll crumble.
Any particular players on the other team you've got your eye on that you're aware of, or are you not too familiar with?
There's quite a few of them, but the names I wouldn't be really good at pronouncing. But I know that I've been keeping an eye on. Certainly, there's I think the skipper from Malaysia, Riaz or Fiaz, I think I'm not 100% sure of his name, but you know, I've been following him, and he seems to be scoring quite heavily, you know, on a consistent base for the Malaysian side. But I don't want to, you know, worry too much about the opposition. Yes, you know, I think we need to, you know, have, you know, targeted plans against players. But I think it's more about, you know, us executing our skills, you know, to the best that we can. And I think if we can do that, well, then I have no doubt, you know, we'll do very well in the tournament, you know, regardless of who we're playing.
So the three Asian sides coming into the tournament have been playing 50-over cricket regionally in the last couple of months. There isn't any 50-over regional cricket within Europe on an international level. Do you think ICC Europe should look at bringing something like that back?
Yeah, definitely. I think so. I think, you know, we'll just use the Danish side, for example. We've only played two... Well, they don't play on... There is a turf wicket here, which actually the guys trained on for the first time today. And it's actually a very good wicket, but, you know, and then outside of that, we've only had two games as a squad together, which, you know, especially leading into a big tournament, you know, it's not really ideal. I think, you know, all the associate countries that, you know, that ideally they want to be playing as much against, you know, the best opposition that they can, you know, whether in Division 4 or 3 or whatever it is, you know, and it's the only way they're going to get better. You know, you can't be relying on a couple of games a year and then just going back to club cricket. You know, I think that's where Division 1 now is very lucky. You know, the associate countries there, they're getting a lot of cricket against higher nations. And, you know, you can see how the strength of Division 1 has really kicked on over the last couple of years, you know, with the amount of cricket these guys are getting. So I think it needs to filter through, you know, through the divisions. And you're only going to get better cricket right throughout the divisions.
And your hopes for the tournament, obviously aiming to get promoted, is that a reasonable aim?
Yeah, I think so. Obviously, you know, you're going into any tournament, you want to do really well. I think if we really perform to our capabilities, and obviously having Amjad Khan's a massive coup there with the bowling, we have got a strong bowling lineup, which has been proven before that we've bowled out good sides, but it's just the batting side of things that, you know, potentially we haven't played to, you know, the ability that we do have on board. So I really think if we can get a couple of guys that are scoring regularly, big scores, hundreds and that, I think, you know, we can really push for that, you know, one and two spots. But, you know, I don't want to underestimate any of the other teams, and they're going to be as hungry as we are. And, you know, a lot of these sides have played a lot more cricket this year than us together, like especially on turf. You know, which is what it's going to be all played on. So, and a lot of our guys don't have much experience on turf. But even though, you know, I think it's quite easy to adapt from the conditions here to on turf, where the wicket's going to be very good. And you know, and I know these guys from, you know, our side here are going to love, you know, playing on those wickets, especially with the fast outfields, which they don't have in Denmark, where, you know, they'll really get full value for their shots. But again, just going back to your original question, you know, I think the big thing for me is if we can play really good cricket, and if we get beaten by a better side on the day, we get beaten by a better side on the day. That's just, you know, the way it goes. But, you know, I'm sure if we play to our ability and tick all the boxes, then I'm really confident that we'll do well.
And what about sort of your own coaching career? Is there an option to stay on to Division 3 should Denmark get promoted?
Yeah, I like to think so. You know, originally the contract was only for 3 months for whatever reason that Danish cricket, you know, decided. But, you know, I saw it as a great opportunity. And, you know, ideally if we you know, get promoted, then I'd like to think, you know, it'd be an absolute certainty. But, you know, I know that the powers that be over here are really happy with what I've been doing. But in the end, you know, who knows what could happen, you know, they might have other people lined up or, you know, so I'm not really focusing on that, to be honest. It's just here for the 3 months, do the best that I can, and then, you know, and take it from there.
And what about, are you doing any coaching back in Ireland as well, or is that...
Yeah, I was before I left, I was doing, obviously I worked with the national ladies side for a couple of years, and and that tenure finished up, and you know, my great mate Trent Johnson's taken over that and is doing obviously a very good role, a very good job there. So I decided, you know, I went out on my own and doing, you know, my own private specialist batting coaching, which is obviously, you know, my main love, and that was going really well. But you know, when this sort of offer came up, you know, I thought it'd be a great opportunity, you know, again, to get back into a sort of a head coach role. And so, you know, I took it on board, and I've absolutely loved every minute over here. The, you know, the people have been fantastic, and the players have really, you know, bought into, you know, what I've been trying to, the cricket that I want them to play. And, you know, so it's been great.
And just looking at sort of how Ireland have kicked on in recent years, you were there right at the beginning of the 2007 World Cup with the century against Zimbabwe. You must be really proud of what they've gone on to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I suppose the real pleasing factor is, you know, you look at the way cricket in Ireland has just boomed from that, I suppose, from the 2007 World Cup. And, you know, the amount of Irish, actually, guys that are in the senior squad now compared to probably, you know, 2007 when, you know, I suppose it had to happen that stage, you know, with a certain amount of, you know, overseas players, which I don't like to use the word overseas because, you know, four or five or six of us were living in Ireland and married to, you know, or going out with Irish women. So, but, you know, it's fantastic to see how, you know, now they've got a first-class structure happening there. And I think it's just going to go from strength to strength, I would like to think, you know, that hopefully one day their ambitions are that Ireland will be playing test match cricket.
And I suppose it sort of sets an example for other associates to follow as well, doesn't it?
Oh, well, absolutely. And I suppose that's where, you know, I have sort of the inside knowledge, you know, of how, you know, what got Ireland actually to where they are now. And, you know, that's, you know, I've been trying to, you know, spread the word a little bit over here on you know, why Ireland, you know, have got to where they were. Because it wasn't too long ago, actually, that, you know, Denmark were actually beating Ireland, mm-hmm. you know. So, and for some whatever reason, you know, they've sort of slipped by the wayside. But hopefully, you know, they can, you know, get back to, you know, where they were maybe 10, 15, 12 years ago.
Well, just about wraps it up, so just wish you good luck for the tournament, and thanks for coming on the show to talk to us.
Cheers, mate, no problems at all.
Andrew, we just heard from Jeremy Brown with Cricket League Division 4, which will be starting soon in Singapore. It's an interesting tournament because there are three Asian sides involved and three European sides, so it's fairly narrow as far as these tournaments go in regional representation. And also, I guess, because we've actually seen all of these teams playing each other fairly recently, particularly in the regional competitions, you should have a reasonably good idea of how they're going to perform. But on the other hand, they've also tended to be very, very close to the matches between these sides, so it's probably still a bit of a lottery.
Yeah, very much so. I think all the teams are relatively even matched, and it could come down to, you know, one or two individual performances that could well make the difference. One of those could well come from Amjad Khan, who has come back to Danish cricket now. His county career has finished, as we heard from Jeremy Bray. He makes a huge difference to the side. He provides that sort of rapid pace bowling that isn't particularly common at this level. A lot of the players won't be used to batting against the bowlers of that pace. And we saw against in Denmark played two games against Guernsey last month. In the first game, Amjad Khan played and Guernsey were bowled out for about 180. He didn't play in the second game and Guernsey scored about 250. And a player of that quality at this level can, you know, literally mean that sort of difference, that 70-run difference. He can make such a huge change to the side that he can be the difference between winning and losing a match. He played for England. He's played a lot of county cricket. He is an extremely experienced bowler, and we could well see a very different Danish side. You know, the batting has often been their weakness, but if Amjad Khan can ensure that they don't have as bigger total to chase so that they can defend lower totals, then perhaps the batting becomes less important.
Yeah, looking at the other European sides, Italy had done very well last year, but to some extent they won't be as strong in this tournament, and so I think Petra Cole is missing, and obviously Berg is missing as well. So they're probably fairly well matched with Denmark, you'd think.
Yeah, you'd certainly agree with that, but you know, it's been a while since Italy have played any 50-over cricket. It's in, you know, just over a year, whereas the other teams have all played at least some 50-over cricket at an international level recently. You know, Italy, they did have a reasonably successful T20 qualifier, finished, I think, ninth in the end. But, yeah, missing a couple of places. And Berg, not eligible to play in the World Cricket League because the development criteria apply and he doesn't meet them. So it's a different side. And, you know, they didn't play particularly well in World League Division 3. Obviously, they got relegated. So they'll certainly be hoping to be able to go straight back up. But given that the other teams have been playing some 50-over cricket and playing 50-over cricket well recently, I think they could struggle.
Yeah, and Jersey's certainly a team that's been playing quite a bit of it and well, because they've been promoted in both the last World Cricket League tournaments without a defeat.
Yeah, your three promotions, perhaps a little too much to expect. Obviously, only Afghanistan have done that in the past, and then, you know, that's Afghanistan. They're very much a special case, a very talented side, and I don't think Jersey are capable of doing that, but they'll certainly be looking to stay in Division 4, and your promotion is perhaps a little too much out of the question, but yeah, certainly staying in Division 4 will be their aim.
And with the Asian sides, we know Malaysia and Singapore have played each other quite often. Singapore's generally come out worse in those matches, but Oman looked very good in the Premier League recently with some good wins, so they'll probably be the favourites to come to the top of the Asian teams, and probably as a promoted team.
Yeah, you'd certainly back Oman to be promoted. You know, Malaysia and Singapore, overall Singapore have come out on the losing end in their recent matches. You know, Malaysia had a poor tournament in their most recent 50-over tournament, the ACC Premier League, and then Singapore have just, as we've already discussed, had a very successful tournament in the ACC Elite League. So those two teams are perhaps a little closer than their results against each other might suggest. So coming into a tournament with confidence always helps, but you're a man, you're certainly looking at being the top, the best of the three Asian sides.
Of course, Malaysia and Singapore being practically home as well, you couldn't possibly write them off either.
No, the home sides, as we've seen many times in the past, always do well in the World Cricket League tournaments.
The other big tournament coming up is the European Division 2, Andrew. There's six teams involved in this. Belgium, who've come up from Division 3, Austria, Germany, Gibraltar, the Isle of Man, and Norway. Your tip, I'm guessing that's they're fairly evenly matched across the board, which is generally the case. I guess Germany's probably would be one of the favourites.
Yeah, you're probably looking at between Germany and maybe Norway. Norway are a bit of a hit and miss team. It sort of depends. Almost depends what mood their players are in. They can have very good tournaments, and they can also have very bad tournaments. Being played in Essex in England, of course, and so you're looking at the teams that are used to playing on turf wickets, which the only one of these teams, participating teams that has turf wickets at home is the Isle of Man, so you can't rule them out. And Belgium, of course, have, you know, Brighton Watambo, and we saw what sort of difference he made in Division 3, and, you know, he could well make something of a difference here. But yeah, I think you were looking at between Germany and Norway to get promoted, but any of the other teams could get close, and it'll be an interesting tournament. And they'll get to play some games on the county ground in Chelmsford on the opening day, with the Isle of Man and Norway playing a floodlit game, which will be a new experience for them. And yeah, it'll be an interesting tournament. And as we say, between Germany and Norway to get promoted, I think.
Yeah, somewhat disappointing that the tournament is actually running midweek. Would have been good to have it on the weekend, so that partly for the players' ability to take time off, although they're probably taking time off in preparation, but also just if you're going to hold it in a at the county ground, you hope that you get some locals down.
Yeah, yeah, you know, I think not starting it maybe on the Sunday and having a, you know, trying to get some of the locals to come and watch the matches, you know, a unique event. The local media has to be fair, being very very good at trying to promote the tournament. I've read a few articles recently, and you know, they've managed to avoid the normal sort of patronising tone that can sometimes accompany articles of this sort, which there certainly was in Sussex in Division 1 last year, but it's been avoided, fortunately, in the previews for this tournament. And hopefully that, you know, some people will come to the matches and you'll learn about cricket in these countries. It's, just looking at the structure of the tournament, we saw in Division 3 in Spain where they weren't playing two games a day. The teams where they played in the afternoon so that you had the morning free for in case there was any games abandoned. And we don't have that this time. Obviously Monday everybody just plays once on the county ground, and then Tuesday both teams have games in the morning and afternoon. Then on the Wednesday is a rest day, and then on Thursday it's games in the morning and afternoon. And there's no, you know, if it ends up raining on Thursday, you've got, you know, two complete rounds of matches washed out. And it's not a particularly satisfactory way of structuring a tournament. This, you know, you'd think that they should maybe extend it by a couple of days and have some more reserve sessions. But, you know, they're looking at saving money on hotel costs, and they're just not doing that, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think even just having on the Wednesday afternoon and the Thursday afternoon instead of both on Thursday would have been sensible. There might be some ground reasons, potentially.
Yeah, although, you know, with it being played during the week, you have to assume that there's not much club cricket being played, but you know, who knows.
There's also a few one-day matches being played, although they may not have one-day status anymore. The Netherlands is playing Scotland in 350 over games on the 1st, 2nd and 4th of July.
Yeah, this series is, I think, it's essentially almost a part of the North Sea Pro Series. It'll be the players that played in that event that will be playing for the Netherlands and Scotland in this. You won't be seeing the Scottish county players involved, and obviously the Dutch don't currently have any county players, but I don't think the Dutch will be bringing along, say, Tom Cooper or anything like that. So it will be slightly weaker Dutch and Scottish sides, and I'll be at the third game if any of our listeners are also there and want to try and find me. Should be an interesting series with maybe between two relatively closely matched sides, and hopefully the weather in Glasgow will behave.
Speaking of Scotland, they've recently announced that they'll have a new ground in Stirling, which will be good for them when they host the qualifiers next year, as well as being able to host the international matches.
Yeah, and you know, it's good that they've got a ground in a different part of Scotland as well. You see in a lot of associate countries that all the best grounds tend to be grouped relatively close together, but Scotland has managed to avoid that. You know, you've got grounds in Glasgow, they've got grounds in Edinburgh, they've got one up in Aberdeen, they've now got this one in Stirling. So you've got a very wide variety of venues to play at, which will be beneficial to the players. And yeah, it'll be I think it's already been approved to be used in that World 2020 qualifier next year. And there's a lot of other sports being played as part of the facility, which is coming from the regional authorities there. There's also going to be a national centre for curling and a couple of other sports there as well. So, you know, they've got local government support, and if you have local government support, it does help. And if you don't, then things can go wrong, which is what we saw in the US.
There's speaking of tournament news, the ICC has also released the details for World Cricket League Division 3, which somewhat surprisingly will be in Uganda in late October.
Yeah, we initially heard rumours that it would be in Nepal, and then USACA offered to host it in Florida, but it's ended up being given to Uganda, which is a bit of a surprise. You know, the facilities in Florida are very good, but obviously with USACA potentially facing suspension, that perhaps ruled them out. But real surprise that Nepal didn't get it. And just as we've seen in the past, you know, Nepal gets good crowds at their tournaments, and you know it always helps when you're trying to sell the game at this level to be able to show a game being played in front of a, you know, a big and passionate crowd. And I don't think we're going to get that in Uganda the same way we get in Nepal.
Yeah, one possible reason Nepal didn't get it is they have their own corruption scandal. It's hard to get some much news of it, but it looks like 10 board members are under investigation, and they've appointed 3 others to take over while that's ongoing.
Yeah, there's been a lot of problems in Nepali cricket over the last few years. The players went on strike briefly earlier this year ahead of a domestic tournament in Nepal, and there's long been concerns that the Cricket Association of Nepal are not doing it what they should, that there's people there just in it for themselves rather than for cricket. And hopefully any corruption can be rooted out and stamped out.
Hardly needs to be said that USACA's got issues with corruption, but there's possibly also some issues in the US generally, that the league structures that USACA had, where they have a lot of autonomy, means that there's a few issues with players who are under investigation for match fixing, and officials playing in leagues. In this particular case, the Southern California Cricket Association's had an umpire who's been banned by the Bangladesh for corruption in the Bangladesh Premier League.
Yeah, the Southern California Cricket Association is a member of the American Cricket Federation, of course, and they also had Mohammed Ashraful, who's been banned by Bangladesh, playing in that tournament, and now Nadir Shah, the umpire, is umpiring in that league. And yeah, this you do have a bit of a Wild West situation in US cricket now, and it can be hard for the two governing bodies to really know what's going on. Obviously the size of the US, you perhaps need to have some sort of decentralised structure, and that does have its advantages. That means you can concentrate your resources where you need to concentrate them, but it also has disadvantages in that you have little control over the leagues in terms of their officials and whatnot, and you do run the risk of a league going rogue as such. And it looks like the Southern California Cricket Association has gone rogue, so to speak, and you're picking banned players, they're allowing banned players and banned officials to take part. And I think the American Cricket Federation need to come down hard on the Southern California Cricket Association. Jamie Harrison on Twitter has said that they can't be expected to check every player and every official, and he's right, they can't be. But once you're made aware of this, then you need to start taking action and ensure that at the very least these players are banned from playing in the Southern California Cricket Association leagues and from officiating in them. And whether that means putting sanctions against the league and for their representative side in the American Cricket Federation Champions League, as they call it, whether that happens or not is a matter for them. But I think some sanctions certainly need to be put against the Southern California Cricket Association. But perhaps the ICF are in an uncomfortable position that they can't really annoy the leagues too much, because they could just defect and rejoin USACA, or just go out on their own when, you know, the American Cricket Federation are trying to show that they are the governing body for cricket in the US. They need to be able to control what's going on, and they're not controlling what's going on, and they need to do something about this.
Yeah, I think it's in their best interest, both if they were ever to take over as the sole governing body in the US, but also as a way of representing to the leagues that we are the governing body that is not corrupt and doesn't abide with any of those types of practices, that they need to do something to make sure that that's the line that they're travelling with. If the Southern California Cricket Association was to defect, as big a loss as that might be, it's better for the ACF to maintain its incorruptibility and its standards than to have a league like that involved in their competition.
Yeah, you know, it enables the ACF to say to the ICC, look, we're taking corruption seriously. Whereas the current situation allows USACA to say to the ICC, well, look, the American Cricket Federation are allowing banned players to play and banned officials to officiate. And it's a propaganda war at the moment, and if the ACF don't take action here, they risk losing the propaganda war on this issue.
There is a broader issue here with US cricket that, as you say, it is a Wild West. There's so many leagues and people involved in US cricket who just want to go in there and make some money, and that one way to make money is to bring in players who don't have anything else to do because they've been banned by the ICC, but they do have big names, and this is what's happened in a couple of cases. And to run these unaffiliated tournaments that have cash prizes that get the big name players across, knowing that there's a certain amount of money for people who come to watch it, or for people who've been involved in it to put their money on the table to play with them. But it's bad for US cricket to have this constant grind of people trying to just pull money in and out of the game, and to not actually have these kind of structures in place, because it's endemic to the US cricket that's how everything is structured and run.
Yeah, you have you know, no overarching structure. Obviously, the ACF have tried to put one in, but you know, there's been so many years of no structure being provided, or very little structure being provided. So, of course, your private tournaments are going to spring up to fill the void. Your cricketers want to play cricket, and if their governing body isn't providing that for them, then private companies are going to provide it for them. And you know, as we discussed on our last episode, you know, those private individuals are perhaps not as concerned about potential corruption and match fixing as an official governing body would be.
Keeping on US cricket and America's cricket, we spoke, or you spoke last week about the Women's Cricket Now initiative to reinstate the ICC America's Women's Tournament, which has been scrapped. We got some more news out of that with some recent articles that indicate that the America's Development Manager was in fact the person behind the scrapping of the tournament, proposing that it wasn't played.
Yeah, this sort of surprised me a lot. You know, it's not a command from Dubai to say, look, this tournament's a waste of money, let's scrap it. It was Ben Kavanagh, the Regional Development Manager, actually saying to Dubai, look, I think we should scrap this tournament. And you know, it's also come out that there's going to be no America's representative in the qualifiers for the 2016 World 2020, the 2018 World 2020, and the 2017 50-over World Cup. And that is a real blow to women's cricket in the Americas. And you know, Ben Kavanagh's job, he's the regional development manager. His job is to develop cricket, and that includes women's cricket. And he's not developing women's cricket. He's actually curtailing it. He's actually preventing it from developing.
Yeah, I can see the statistics given, and it's hard to find statistics on women's cricket, is that there are only 200 players in the United States, which is even fewer than they have junior players, and there's not very many of them. It's not a lot better in Argentina or Canada. In fact, it's probably worse in both of those nations. So on the one hand, you can see why it would be hard to justify having an international tournament when, you know, almost 10% of 20% of the people involved in cricket in those countries are actually being flown out to somewhere to play a tournament. But for the ICC Americas, they should be embarrassed that they have such poor growth of women's cricket. The East Asia Pacific claims to have 47% participation by women in their region. I think that's within the junior development program, but that's obviously higher than anywhere else, and it's somewhat unexpectedly high, but that's what they should be aiming for, almost a 50-50 representation. And to have it be something like 1% of the cricketers in the region being women should actually be an embarrassment to the ICC Americas, and they should be doing everything they can to promote women's cricket and to realise that that's just not good enough.
Yeah, and if you're going to cancel the tournament, then because there's not enough women playing, then you're putting in place some programmes to try and increase women's participation. But there's absolutely no evidence that ICC Americas are doing that.
One possible reason for that too, as well, is that the ICC funding model doesn't actually have an entry for women's cricket in its scorecard. It has just about everything else. It has umpires and it has junior development and juniors and grounds, but there's no line item for women's cricket. And women are obviously included within the men's thing, but that itself is actually something that needs to be addressed. There should be an entry for women on the ICC development scorecard to say, well, you should be doing this. This should be one of your priorities, because it's supposed to be one of the priorities of the ICC.
In this day and age, we really should be trying to, treat women's sport the same as men's sport, and it might not be commercially as attractive, but that's no reason for the governing body to not treat it the same. There's another potential problem here in that the top eight teams in women's cricket now are going to be taking part in a league over a couple of years, similar to the World Cricket League Championship. And with those teams playing more and more against each other, you run the risk of those teams just pulling away so much from the rest that it becomes hard to close the gap, and you might see this sort of thing happening in other regions as well. And part of the problem, I think, is that women's cricket is actually just stuck under development as general, and that includes full member women's cricket. The England women's team are treated as a development team, the same as Ireland are, or the same as Papua New Guinea are, or whatever. And that shouldn't happen. The development budget shouldn't be used to be funding the women's programs of full members. The full members are supposed to be funding their own women's programs, as far as I'm concerned, and that isn't happening. And I think the whole way that the ICC run women's cricket needs to be re-looked at.
On a similar note, the ICC came out and said that the WICL, which had been mooted for Singapore, will not have their support. The ECB and the Cricket Australia have both indicated that they're not going to send players to it, and which would be somewhat disappointing for associate players, because there was a hint that they would get a spot on each squad for those to bring them forward.
Yeah, it's very disappointing. It's part that the ICC have a phobia almost of private tournaments. You saw this back in the 70s with World Series cricket, and you saw it again with the Indian Cricket League, although the Indian Cricket League turned out to be incredibly corrupt. But you need, if the correct response to this would be to talk to the people who are involved in trying to set up this tournament and say, look, you'll let us come and let us assist you, let us ensure that you get a legitimate tournament, that the tournament is run properly, and you not to say, sod off and we're not going to help you. They should be stepping in and saying, look, we want our women's players to be able to play professionally. There's hardly any professional women's cricketers around the world, and this was a tournament that could have helped that. But to adopt this antagonistic attitude to it is just wrong, in my opinion.
Yeah, I can certainly see why they wouldn't want private entrepreneurs taking over, and we've already mentioned that in this episode. And I can also see that Australia's looking at producing a Women's Big Bash, and England might at some point look for a 2020 style tournament in England. But it is one of those, as you say, it's something that they could support, or it's something that they could bring together and work with a partnership in. It strikes me as a little bit disingenuous to say, as Giles Clark did in the articles about this, that the ICC is focusing on this new ICC tournament with the eight teams, and that's going to be what's going to happen going forward, and that the World 2020 every 2 years is going to be sufficient, because this tournament would have allowed cricketers from around the world to play. It would have provided opportunities for them to play at times when they're not necessarily having opportunities in Australia or England. It is one of those, it looks like a purely commercial decision, which is at some level fair enough, because the ICC member boards are purely commercial things, but it's also something that they could have been more open to and accommodating of if they'd worked with them rather than, as you say, being antagonistic.
Yeah, you look at the IPL, just to use an example. That is an example of a partnership between private organisations and official organisations, and that has worked really well. You know, the IPL is one of the richest sports leagues in the world now, and you know, the ICC could have adopted that sort of approach to this tournament rather than, as we say, the antagonistic approach they've got, and I think they're wrong to do that.
The last piece of news, Andrew, was that Ireland had been looking to tour Pakistan, and as a result of more terrorism in that country, it looks like that's going to be curtailed.
Yeah, there was a plan to play 3 1-day internationals in Lahore in September. Ireland have been quite desperate to get fixtures ahead of the World Cup, and have not been able to. And I'm not particularly sure why this series therefore can't be shifted to the UAE like other Pakistan series have been over the last few years. You know, the arrangements were very close to being finalised, and obviously these tragic events in Karachi have prevented it. And it's a real shame. It's a shame, obviously, for Irish cricket. It's also a shame for Pakistan cricket, who have not been able to play their games at home. One of the sort of most surprising things, that it was Ireland who were going to be playing these matches. You know, Afghanistan have played in Pakistan in the last couple of years. They played a series against Pakistan A, I think, 2 years ago. Afghanistan have shown willing to tour Pakistan. I'm a bit surprised that Afghanistan aren't also being involved in talks to play a series of one-day internationals in Pakistan. But yeah, very disappointing for Ireland that they're not going to get these high-quality games before the World Cup. They are touring Australia and New Zealand, I think, in November, but those matches are going to be not even against state sides. You're going to be against, I think, sides sort of in between the state level and grade cricket, and the whole build up to the World Cup for the associates is pretty terrible. The ICC are not ensuring that they get a good preparation for the tournament. Scotland don't have any matches, the UAE don't have any matches, and the ICC need to be able to start putting in place a structure that enables the associates to take part in the World Cup to get warm-up matches. Otherwise, they're not going to be successful. But then, maybe that's the idea.
Yeah, I wonder with the not moving it to the UAE whether there is something of a commercial nature to that decision. I think Pakistan does quite well out of the matches in the UAE, but it's possible that they weren't actually expecting to make much money out of this, and the main reason they wanted to do it was to convince any team, regardless of who that team was, to come to Pakistan to prove that they could make Pakistan safe enough for much bigger and much more lucrative teams to come to Pakistan. And there's something slightly unsettling about that, but they're trying to use teams that don't get many fixtures. Bangladesh was another one they've been trying to get along a lot to come under these circumstances.
Yeah, I certainly think there's an element of that, and having an island or a Bangladesh or an Afghanistan can perhaps be seen as almost a low risk thing that for that they're not having if you're in England or Sri Lanka comes and there's trouble, as I say, it's going to make them. You make teams even less likely to come. Whereas if Ireland can come and it's trouble free, then it says, well, Pakistan to some extent is open for business, and that more teams will be able to come and play the odd test match and the odd one international in Pakistan. And yeah, it's a little worrying that Pakistan are essentially using these teams to try and prove that point.
All right, that's all we have this episode. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you, Russ.